In brightest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light!
Welcome to Green Lantern's Light, where we cover the Green Lantern comics ranging from 1984 forward. My name is J. David Weider.
I am Michael Bradley.
And I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And this week we got some humdingers of issues ranging from Green Lantern 175 through Green Lantern 177. And spoiler, the shark is here.
Dun-na, dun-na,
dun-na. We're going to need a bigger boat.
Nice. So we don't really have much to cover, so I think I have the first synopsis. At least I hope so, because that would be really awkward if I didn't, which is Green Lantern 175. This bad boy went on sale January 19th, 1984. Cover dated April 1984. It cost a whopping 75 cents, which, when I did the math, is 25% of what we pay for a single issue now.
Which, yeah, with the rate of inflation, is not that different.
Not really, no. But it still hurts.
You punched me in the wallet.
Yes. This issue was written by Len Wein. Artist was Dave Gibbons, also the cover artist. Colored by Anthony Tolan. And was edited by Len Wein. Can you really edit yourself?
Yeah, Jack Kirby did it.
Well, yeah, sort of. But that's because who's going to edit Jack Kirby?
Right.
Well, Michael Bradley edits himself on this episode.
Exactly.
Oh, good. Touche. I'm sorry. Well, this issue begins with an introduction to, well, reintroduction to Congressman Jason Block. It's our introduction because we weren't around earlier. He likes to talk expositionally to himself about having a personal fortune in the multi-millions, a network of agents, and he has the whole world under his thumb except for where Green Lantern is concerned. If anybody had a tape recorder, Congressman Block would be doing hard time because he admits to hiring the Javelin to steal Ferris Aircraft's solar engine and tried to use a rocket bomb to wipe Ferris off the map. And if he'd gotten away with it, he would have gotten away with it too if not for that meddling Green Lantern. Block then gets a visit.
And his little dog too.
Yep, exactly. Well, that's kind of the whole speech he's giving here. Block then gets a visit from a man in black named Smith, who will now be... played by Hugo Weaving, who actually represents International Petroleum, who demands that Block leave Ferris Aircraft alone. But since Block believes that Carl Ferris murdered his father, he looks at the request as an outrage. And with more exposition, we learn that Carl and Conrad Block were partners until Ferris stole the company from Block. And despondent, Conrad was physically scarred in an attempt to sabotage Ferris Air. Then in one final attempt from Green Lantern 140, Conrad Block was killed by his own device, an event that Jason Block blames on Carl Ferris and Green Lantern. Smith understands that, but Jason...
So he's Harry Osborn.
He's very Harry Osborn. Very. And Smith understands that, but Jason should let the International Petroleum finish their business with Ferris, and then he can take his revenge. And Jason tells Smith to take a hike, and then pulls out his ace in the hole, a file folder marked Hal Jordan / Green Lantern. Now, speaking of Hal Jordan, we're on book page 5 of this issue, which is basically 5 pages of expositional dialogue. We finally catch up with Hal and Carol having breakfast after a night of sex. I'd pause so you could cut that out, but I thought it would get more of a laugh.
Okay.
Okay. Hal discovered
it's okay because they're having coffee.
Okay. But Lois Lane couldn't have cornflakes with Perry White.
I was about to make exactly that. Doing it for me.
Where was I? Okay. Hal discovers that his friend, the Flash, has been on trial for the murder of the Reverse Flash, and Carol suggests that Hal go catch up with Barry. So Hal powers up and heads to Central City. While elsewhere, the Shark happens upon a homeless man and drains him of his life energy. But that's not enough, so he continues to look for more victims.
Because the Shark is also the parasite.
Yeah. In Central City, the Flash is fighting with the Rainbow Raider and losing when Hal intervenes and knocks the villain out with a pair of giant stop sign constructs. Afterward, Barry and Hal have a heart-to-heart, where Barry explains that the Reverse Flash was about to kill his fiancée, Fiona Webb, the same way that he killed Iris Allen. But now the real question is, did the Flash mean to kill Reverse Flash? Barry just doesn't know. And Hal tells Barry that if he needs a character witness, he knows where to find him, and then Hal takes off. Back at a lab in Coast City, Clay Kendall is displaying his new device, the Psy Chair, to Jake and April, a device that theoretically can unlock the remaining 90% of the potential in the human brain. And Clay won't be satisfied until he can move things with the sheer force of will like Green Lantern. So Clay tests the device, and to his horror, it works. But he touched another mind, something monstrous, and it's out there searching for prey. That would be the Shark, who has felt the presence but decides to disregard it completely and take his revenge on Star Labs for creating him. Shark pops the top off of a fire hydrant and uses the water spray to propel himself into a Star Labs facility and starts wreaking havoc and draining people left and right. Green Lantern happens upon the scene and, after being brought up to speed by the emergency personnel, goes to tackle the problem. Shark and GL trade blows, but Shark gains the upper hand when he releases a pure raw fear in Hal, which Hal is able to push past, but Shark is now able to drain Hal's life energy, which causes a lot of pain in Shark for some reason. Still, Shark summons a geyser and escapes as Hal lies in a catatonic state on the ground, and we leave this issue with our hero defeated.
You guys care if I go first on this one?
Oh, by all
go
means.
For it.
Pages 1 and 2, David, you stole my joke, my Scooby-Doo reference.
I'm sorry.
I actually have that in my notes, and I would have gotten away with it, too.
Well, you can make a different joke about Shaggy and Scooby smoking pot.
Okay.
Come on, it's obvious.
Page 4, I was surprised that the revelation is that Block knew or knows that Hal Jordan is Green Lantern. And I'm actually curious about where that's going to go because I don't know. Page 5, I like how Ween used the newspapers to transition scenes throughout the issue. It was kind of a small touch, but a nice one.
And hard to put in a synopsis.
Well, that's one of those things you really don't need in the synopsis. It's more of just a transition type of deal. But page 6, Carol is kind of a witch here. I mean, I know that Hal snaps at her, but she's far less understanding than she should be given the news he just learned that what is essentially his best friend is on trial for murder. And then just a couple panels later, when Hal says the oath and flies off, she does a complete 180.
It's weird. Yeah, it's unbalanced.
I don't get the part where she's being a witch.
Well, she snaps at him. He finds out that Barry's on trial, and he says, "Carol, why didn't you tell me about this?" And she says, "Oh, for heaven's sake, Hal, you've only been back a couple days."
I didn't take it that way at all. That's interesting. The way that I took it was, you know, it slipped her mind to mention it to him because he's only been back for so long. So the "oh, for heaven's sake" is not "oh, for heaven's sake, you're so silly for wanting to know about this." I thought "oh, for heaven's sake," it completely slipped my mind because you've only been gone for – I mean, you've only come back so recently and, you know, everything that's happened since then. So it just slipped my mind.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, but then she does say any other complaints, right. Mr. Jordan. So, yeah, that is the one moment.
But pages 8 through 11, the script for these pages – this is the scene with the Flash. The script for these pages is identical to pages 18 through 21 of The Flash number 332, which was written by Kerry Bates. I really like this scene between Hal and Barry, but kind of wish the talk between them would have been a little longer. Because as it is, Hal doesn't really do much to console him besides, you know, say, well, if you need a character witness, and I don't necessarily get the idea that they're good friends as opposed to just friendly colleagues.
Yeah, and it does kind of go against their history.
Yeah, and I'm not really sure how Hal using his ring to probe Barry's mind would be akin to him playing God, or even what the ring was supposed to tell him.
Yeah, I'm kind of jumping into my own notes here with that, but I think that Hal actually, as a good friend to Barry, owes it to him, especially if Barry says, you know, I honestly just don't know. Did I mean to kill him, or did he just end up being killed while I was trying to do this? I don't know. If Hal has the ability with his ring to get into his mind and, you know, figure out a definitive answer for that and then be able to tell Barry, leave him with that information so that he can then deal with it on those terms, I think that's exactly what a friend should do.
Right.
And I think that both these characters, as superheroes especially, are mature enough to be able to deal with things on those terms. And it's kind of like saying, yes, we're both adults, but let's be middle school about it.
Right.
Well played, sir.
It was interesting, though, seeing the Rainbow Raider in a Green Lantern comic, given the changes that are coming to the Green Lantern mythology, well, that have come just the last few years.
True.
Especially since he uses his Crimson Anger Beam here. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Now, I don't think he was around in post-crisis. post-crisis, was he?
The Rainbow. There is a post-crisis Rainbow Raider, but I think he's been killed off.
Okay.
I think he was killed off before Johns came on the Green Lantern title. I would have
that
to.
That would have been a great segue.
Yeah.
That would have been like a perfect in.
I think that in the post-crisis that there are plenty of gay characters to deal with. You don't need the Rainbow Raider.
You took the joke. Thank you.
Pages 12 and 13. For some reason, I really don't want to like this Clay Kendall character, but scenes like this make it difficult not to. But then we get to page 14 with the Shark, who is a character that I want to like, but he's just so goofy. And I think a lot of that is just the way he's drawn, because the depiction of him is fine. I don't have any problems with the way he's written. It's just the visual of the character is very bizarre with the
See, I wasn't aware of this, but I always pictured him looking more like King Shark from Superboy, from right. The post-crisis Superboy. And apparently that was not accurate. And what kind of shark is a peach color?
I have no idea.
Okay, it's not just me.
A tiger shark.
Really?
No, oh. I have no idea.
Okay.
Page 18 through 20, I really like the fight between the shark and the Green Lantern, but an invisible yellow force field? I mean, really? If it's invisible, is it really yellow?
Yes, that's my note, too. Okay. If it's invisible, it does not reflect light or refract light
right.
In the color of yellow. There's no such thing as an invisible yellow anything.
Right.
If it's invisible, it's not colored. Sorry. Okay, go on.
Page 21, I have this original issue, and the page directly following page 21 is an ad for it's the Veterans Bedside Network, and it's one of those ads that looks like a comic page, and it's drawn by Joe Kubert. Well, the most noticeable panel on the page is a close-up shot of Ed McMahon's face. So I'm reading here, and Hal says, "Even sharks must be afraid of something, but what? I remember reading something about it. Of course, that's it." And then you look at the next page, and you see
Ed McMahon.
Yeah. But, of course.
Which makes more sense than dolphins.
That's just what I was getting to, yeah. Okay. The real resolution is almost as funny because Hal uses a dolphin with teeth, big, sharp dagger teeth, to scare the shark into submission. But, I mean, I guess there is some truth behind that. I guess there is something sharks not liking dolphins, but...
Sharks don't like dolphins, but they're not really enemies, and sharks right. are not afraid of dolphins because sharks can kill dolphins.
Right.
Dolphins cannot kill sharks.
Right.
So, unless they're very, very small sharks.
But it's still better than Ed McMahon, so... What I don't understand, though, is if this, quote-unquote, invisible yellow force field can deflect bullets, then how is slamming his head into the concrete and punching him going to help?
Yeah.
And just where does Hal's ring go? He has it, but then at the bottom half of this page and the next two pages, he doesn't have it. It's gone.
It's in his subconscious. We'll get into that in the next issue.
Okay.
Okay.
Which is another complaint that I have about the next issue. Yeah, it's I can't really hide it. These are all three of these issues are not even close to my favorites. And actually, I think this first one is the one that I dislike the most. Do you guys mind if I go on with my notes? I'm sorry. I thought we were segueing.
Oh no, that's okay. Well, we can. It is kind of part of the segue, but I actually think this was my favorite of the three issues, despite the fact that I just blasted it a lot. It reminded me of a good old-fashioned Saturday morning cartoon, like we watched when we were kids. You know, if you don't put too much thought into it, it's just really fun. But yeah, it's none of the issues we're going to cover this episode are very good. So
it's hard not to put thought into this one. The cover for this really doesn't do anything for me, but it's not that it's even bad. I just really don't care about the shark.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a conversation that I think will end up being off air from the previous episode. The first three issues that we covered in episode two, I just went ahead and let Michael and David pick the issues that they wanted, and I just took the last one. When it came to this one, I actually did take a look ahead and saw, oh, there's two parts about the shark. I already don't care about the shark. I'll take Hector Hammond.
Right.
So I just jumped in with that one, but I won't do that every time. But right off the bat, yeah, the cover just doesn't do anything for me. If I saw this on the stand and, you know, if I wasn't already collecting everything Green Lantern, this is not one that would stick out to me and say, oh, I really need this one. I do kind of dig this opening moment. Of course, we know that Green Lantern's not going to die, but it just says, mark this day well, for it may just be the last day in the turbulent life of Green Lantern. And it's one of those things, a lot of comics do this, and I always get a kick out of it, especially when Stan Lee would do stuff like that.
Yeah.
In the 60s. But yeah, you do see this a lot in Golden and Silver Age. But from my point of view, I've read a lot of 60s Stan Lee, and he does that almost every single time, and I love it every single time. The first thing, one thing that I noticed that I didn't even notice before is that Jason Block is so vain that his cufflink is a B.
Yep.
For Block. That's how vain this guy.
I didn't notice that. You're right.
I just noticed it. It's easy to miss. But on pages 1 and 2, I'm already a little bored with Jason Block, and I'm hoping that something worthwhile happens with him soon. But then again, you get to page 4, and, you know, ask and ye shall receive.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're not going to get a whole lot of that over the next couple of issues. It's going to have to hang out until we get to issue 178 at the beginning of the next episode that we do. But once again, I am really tempted to go back to those earlier Green Lantern stories, and I don't even know where to begin just to get myself caught up to this point. I do realize that, you know, once we really get going and are really hip deep in this era, the stuff that came before will be not inconsequential, but less consequential.
Right.
Because this really is the beginning of a new era, which is why we're doing it this way.
Not to spoil too much ahead, but I think that'll just a couple episodes from now, that'll actually
pretty much.
Yeah.
That's my understanding as well. Page 5, Hal checking himself out in the news. Yeah, I'm a whore that way too. So I understand.
Would.
Yeah.
I totally would.
No, in fact, I wrote a story. This was a few years ago. It's one that I want to turn into a comic book. And the main character in the very beginning, he's always checking out all the news reports that he's in, because that's what he gets a kick out of. I'm sure that others will mention this, but this story with the Flash was huge at the time.
Oh yeah.
I've got several of these issues. I'm actually kind of looking for getting the rest of them before I read the whole story, but the whole Flash murder thing is it seems to me like a really great story, and I look forward to reading it at some point, but I haven't yet. On page 6, yes, seeing Hal transform in real life must be pretty amazing, no matter how many times Carol has seen it. And in real life, it probably is.
Yeah.
I'm not even talking about on the movie screen when Ryan Reynolds does it. I mean, like, if you actually saw that in real life, it's probably going to be, wow, that's pretty cool. Page 7. Yeah, I already don't care about Shark. I've already gotten into that a little bit. But what kind of... What does the power of mind drain have to do with a shark? I mean, what sharks do is they eat stuff. That's their whole thing. They right. eat stuff and they swim and they don't stop. That's what sharks do. What does mind draining have anything to do with a shark? I don't understand. I'm just saying that they should stick with the themes that they actually have going. I realize that this is a super evolved shark that evolved millions of years, but I even have to call that into question, which I'm going to get to in just a second. So I know that I've already made a little bit of a joke about this since he's the Rainbow Raider, but you know, wouldn't it be interesting if his sin was pride? Sorry, I'll leave the rest of that alone. Skipping ahead, page 10. Because I really don't have a lot to say about the actual fight with the Rainbow Raider when Hal actually gets there. Does it bother anybody else that the stop sign that he creates with his Green Lantern ring is not green? Or is that just my copy?
No, it wasn't really green. It wasn't red, but...
It came out blue.
Yeah, it came out weird.
What are you talking about? It's green.
It may depend on the one that you have. In my okay. case, it the colors could have faded a little bit. In fact, at this point, I don't see any yellow in the Rainbow Raider's costume. It seems to have turned white. So there may be – it's either a printing error or it's just faded over time.
Yeah.
Curse really you, newsprint.
The copy I'm looking at, it's green and yellow. Okay. So, yeah.
Well, fair enough. I kind of already talked about this, but yeah, if Hal can use the ring to probe Barry's subconscious, I think that he should do it, but that's just me. Page 13, skipping ahead because we have this guy. It's funny, you know, you have the outline of the shark because that's the one that this guy is getting into the head of, but it actually occurred to me that it would even be more interesting if this scene, which doesn't really do anything or mean anything for the sake of this issue, he gets into the shark's mind. I would have preferred that he got into Hector Hammond's mind or something. Ooh. And said, oh, this is something that's coming up. But then again, the Hector Hammond stuff all turned out to be flashback anyway. Right. Page 14, I could be wrong here, but I mean, Shark is off base when he says that he's he's the product of a million years of shark evolution, which happened very quickly in his case. Not to say that it's impossible, but sharks really haven't evolved that much in the past several million years.
Not sharks. Really. I mean, that's kind of one of their major scientific features.
Yes. Like
they're pretty much a throwback to older eras.
Right. And so evolving a million years, you might just end up with another shark. It's really hard to say. But, you know, since he did evolve further, it's impossible to speculate entirely. But
maybe he was bitten by a radioactive shark.
No, he is a radioactive shark. Page
something. I don't know.
Yeah, something. Well, then he got hit with more toxic waste, and so that evolved him even more or something. <I don't
know. laughs> He lives in a sewer with his master splinter.
Because he was flushed down the toilet when he turned out to be too big of a shark. On page 16, there's this thing where you know, Hal Jordan, he's thinking to himself, there's an LAPD SWAT wagon, and it explains that SWAT stands for Special Weapons and Tactics. And that's kind of like where I learned what a lot of these things mean.
Exactly.
Was from comic books. I learned what SWAT meant. I learned what MO stood for, modus operandi, or mode of operations. All sorts of different things that I had heard on various cop shows and even Saturday morning cartoons. They were explained in comic books to me, and that's where I learned a lot of them. And so I just had to point out that there's another one. Even though I didn't read this one when it came out when I was 4 years old. Page 20, yeah, we already talked about that too. Invisible yellow force field. Whatever. Page 22, now sharks are afraid of dolphins. So it's gone from ridiculous to just plain stupid. I'm sorry, sharks are not afraid of dolphins. I mean, maybe they don't mix well, I'm sure. One's a mammal, one's a fish.
Right.
I mean, it's got to be like a – I mean, maybe it's a sort of racist thing. Who knows? But no.
Speciesist.
Speciesist. Well, no, they are different races.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they're different races. They're different – hold on. What is it? Order. It's not order. It's They are different parts of the animal kingdom. One is a fish, one is a mammal. And so it makes sense that they wouldn't necessarily mix. But for sharks to actually be afraid, it's not like how spiders are afraid of snakes.
Are they?
Well, that's what Harry Potter 2 set up.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I don't know if that's actually true. But if most people are afraid of snakes, I imagine spiders would not be necessarily very happy with them. On the whole, I found this to be kind of a lazy issue in the storytelling, and it didn't really accomplish anything that I thought was worthwhile. It's just I like the tie-in with Flash, and that might be about it for what I really find worthwhile about this issue. It was not my intention to go into this and just completely tear it apart, but there were so many little problems, and the big one, I think, is that the shark is not a very good villain to begin with.
No.
And he's on a flawed, faulty premise that does not make very much sense, and it's just weird.
Have you ever read that Superman issue? Or, well, it's Action Comics, actually, but with him
in it? I've not read that one. There's a lot of Bronze Age that I've not read yet. I'm very close to – well, not very close, but somewhat close to having all of the Superman comics from 1971 to the present. And once I do, I will be reading a whole lot of those Bronze Age ones. But there's a lot of Bronze Age that I haven't read, and that's the big reason why I have not guested on Charlie Niemeyer's podcast. He has invited me, and I've said, look, I really don't know what I can even talk about.
Right.
Charlie Niemeyer and – Charlie Niemeyer and...
That's right, he got a co-host.
Yep, that would be me.
That would be some guy.
Some guy on some other show.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do the Super Troopers reference, too.
Okay, so, David.
Yeah, kind of launching off of what you were saying before I start page by page, most villains will normally have some sort of antithesis nature to the hero. How does a shark go up against a cosmic cop? So your logic is solid. It never made sense. I can't believe they even bothered to make action figures of this guy. He would be on my Mort list. But jumping into my page by page,
it's like having Batman go up against Doomsday.
Yeah, exactly. Going into
which
page
just
by
happened.
Page, well, kind of, yeah, yeah. There. Well, I don't want to talk about that. This is not a Superman show.
I want to say that was Superman Batman number 10. I want to say.
And it happened later on, too.
Yeah.
Beginning with pages 1 through 3, this whole Jason block, really we had 4 pages of exposition, because before the era – I guess it would be the era before the era that we started in, basically where, before Hal got sentenced to a year in space, it was kind of a Dallas Knots Landing thing, and we're kind of getting back into that, all the happenings here on Earth, because we have a lot of characters – a lot of, you know, rival companies going at each other. It's a freaking soap opera. So, yeah, we had to get filled in on stuff that happened two sections ago, really. And it was annoying because that burned 4 pages of the book, and I don't feel that it was a necessary 4 pages. But that's just me. Page 4, I did go back and look at Green Lantern number 140, and pretty much that summarizes it. Yeah. Basically, Block – the senior Block went into default, and it was in part of that big soap opera because he put a device on Carol that was essentially a bomb after deforming himself into, as Michael Bradley pointed out, the green skull from Amalgam Comics, and blew himself up. So yeah, we're basically coming back to some very old storylines, and I really wish some of this was left on the wayside. Especially when we look at next issue, there's still more and more that they're adding to it. But I really love how Gibbons draws Carol Ferris. And, I mean, she just looks great on page 6. I love the design. It's very timely for the styles that were present at that time in the 80s. And, of course, Gibbons is hard to really get mad at for much of anything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we may have problems with the writing in these issues, but the art is excellent, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, the art is awesome, which is actually one of my bigger complaints about the third issue we're going to be talking about, is that Gibbons is not part of it.
Yeah.
Well, people need a rest. Jeffrey kind of hit on the Flash storyline that was going on in pages 8 through 10 that they were talking about with Reverse Flash. If you've ever listened to Tom versus the Flash, which is kind of how I got a lot of my Flash stories. This is kind of the storyline that's going to take the book to its conclusion. And I just wanted to point that out, that it was an excellent storyline. My first real contact with Kid Flash was him testifying in Barry's trial. And then we all know that I love Wally, right? Has that been stated enough on Facebook?
Oh, yeah.
Never forget Wally West. So that was a pretty relevant thing for me. It's just that I got in touch with that character.
I was sad when Wally died.
Which time?
Yeah, exactly.
Page 11, Clay Kendall and his random science. Again, we're packing the story with way too many side characters. I like having, you know, some sort of background, some sort of developing storyline, but I don't know how many we have going on here. Slowly I'm keeping track of it, but I have to work to keep track of it. Because we have the whole Clay Kendall thing, we have Congressman Block, and then random science contraptions that really serve no story purpose yet.
I'm so bad with names.
Yeah, I had problems, even though we literally just went over introduced some of these characters. I'm like, wait, who's this guy?
No, what's going to get really interesting is when we get hugely into those alien names. Yeah, right. I'm going to have a hard time with that.
But
I'll do my best.
I have an easier time following the core and the multiple characters than I do with this.
Oh, following them, especially based on the way that they look, is very easy for me because I'm such a visual person. But especially when they're names that are not meant to be pronounced anyway.
Yeah, we may have to work with that.
Yeah.
Page 14 and 15, when Shark invades Star Labs, with a villain, you want to be terrified of them or you want to have some degree of empathy. I have none for the Shark. It's just you're kind of a tool attacking people. And again, I'm in the whole mental thing. How does psychic energy or psychic, you know, mind melding fit in with sharks? Not clear on that. Page 16 and 17, there's a lot of info that the emergency personnel lay on Green Lantern. Like, they have an entire fact file, a whole total who's who entry ready for him when he gets there. And this is only going to be, what, 30 minutes, 45 minutes at most after the whole thing started? And it's still happening. How are they know all this?
Yeah, we're actually going to run into that again over the next couple of issues. Like, where are people getting their information from that they know exactly what's going on when nobody should know what's going on?
Yeah, to quote Wayne's World.
It's to get the exposition out there, even though the people in question who are putting out the exposition shouldn't have the information.
Yeah, to quote Wayne's World, that seems so extraneous at the time.
And to quote the great Muppet Caper, it's plot exposition. It has to go somewhere.
Yes. Page 21, my final note is, I don't understand where the Shark is able to produce this whole fear aspect into him. I mean, is it the invisible not yellow aura that's causing that? Is it him coming in contact with that, or is there something more? I felt like I went back and reread it. I'm like, I don't know if I missed something.
It's that every time that he shows up, you hear the sound da 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 da. It's scary.
A little bit. Overall, it
made me want to not sit on the toilet for a while.
Yeah, I had that issue too. Now that you point that out, of course, American Werewolf and
Sharks in the water. If there's water in the toilet, I rest my case.
Yeah. American Werewolf in London had me jumping off of my bed because I was afraid something was under it. And A Christmas Story had me afraid of Santa Claus for decades.
He'll shoot your eye out.
Yep. Well, he'll kick you down a slide. Right. That scared the crap out of me.
Cujo reinforced my love of cats.
But in terms of this issue, I mean, it was...
But I have a dog on my lap at the moment.
It was weak. It was just weak. The art was solid, but the Shark is not a villain that's worthwhile, and there was just too much cobbled together. It was really strung together by duct tape and wire and a prayer. But overall, those are my notes on the issue. That's just my opinion.
Because the story is 24 pages rather than a normal 23, the Letters by Lantern Light section is only one page this time out. But starting this issue, there are 4 letters about Green Lantern 172, and all of them are praising the new direction for the book. And one of them even mentions that this title is Dave Gibbons's first regular American series, which I didn't realize.
I didn't either.
Wow.
I guess that kind of makes sense now that you put it in context and make it obvious for me.
Yeah. But we're going to take a quick break and play a promo, and then we'll be back for Green Lantern number 176.
Rocketed as a baby from the exploding planet Krypton, Kal-El grew to manhood on Earth, whose yellow sun and lighter gravity gave him fantastic superpowers. In the city of Metropolis, he poses as TV newsman Clark Kent, but battles evil all over Earth and beyond as Superman. Superman of the Bronze Age is a weekly podcast covering the adventures of Superman from 1970 to 1986. Join host Charlie Niemeyer at superbronze1970.libsyn.com.
All right, so Green Lantern number 176 was released on February 16th, 1984, with a May cover date for 75 cents. And the cover was by Dave Gibbons. The story title is Mind Games. We had, for credits, we have Len Wein, writer-editor and co-plotter, along with Dave Gibbons, penciler, Dick Giordano, guest inker, Ben Oda, letterer, and Anthony Tolan, colorist. And this issue picks up shortly after the last one, as a comatose Hal is being treated on scene by paramedics. The news media is covering the situation, including a television reporter by the name of Tawny Young. After Young gets a recap of last issue from a police lieutenant, we cut to the home of Carol Ferris, who, along with Tom Kamaku, is watching the report on television. Carol is worried, but resolves that she and Tom have to do something. Elsewhere, Hal's consciousness finds itself trapped within the shark's mind, along with those of the shark's other victims. In Washington, D.C., Mr. Smith eavesdrops as Jason Block calls the Monitor, demanding more help to wipe out Ferris' heir. The Monitor finally relents, telling Lila to call someone named Rosie. Back at Ferris' heir, Bruce Gordon works on installing the solar engine, while Richard Davis checks on his progress. After Davis experiences a bit of chest pain, but dismisses it as gas, Gordon finds a threatening note from Block, but vows that nothing will stop their work. As Hal makes little progress in his fight in the shark's mindscape, we cut to New Orleans, where Rosie gets a call from the Monitor about a job, and the call is soon forwarded to Rosie's associates, Scoop Shovel, Steamroller, Jackhammer, and Hardhat. In the mindscape, Hal continues to fight the shark, but has even less luck when he finds the power to his ring starting to fade. Carol and Tom arrive at the hospital, and while Tom distracts the guard, Carol slips into Hal's room dressed as a nurse.
Hello, nurse.
With Hal still unconscious, Carol reveals the Green Lantern power battery. Placing Hal's ring to the battery, she recites the oath, but it seems to have no effect. However, in the mindscape, Hal finds his ring recharged, and with a burst of emerald energy, is able to overcome the shark, causing the villain to expel Hal and the other victims from his mind. Hal quickly recovers, and after a few words with Carol, heads out to confront the shark, who is terrorizing a Star Labs tanker looking for more of the radioactive material that caused his latest transformation. After moving the crewmen to safety, Hal tries to reason with the shark, but the shark tosses drums of chemicals at the Green Lantern, which soon mix, catch on fire, and cause the entire tanker to explode. Hal's ring protects him, and he flies off, lamenting that he couldn't save the shark, and saying he hopes that he found peace. Meanwhile, at a deserted L.A. warehouse, Jason Block waits for the help that was promised to him by the Monitor, when suddenly a nearby wall shatters, and in comes Rosie and her crew, otherwise known as the Demolition Team.
Or the DTs.
Or the DTs.
and of course, there's the promise that in the next issue, that will be the big thing that's going on.
Yes.
Yes. Sadly, that will not be the case. So why don't I start with this one?
Okay.
since the next one I'm recapping, and it seems to be the way that we're doing things. Page one, I remember Tawny Young, this character who's the reporter from Millennium in 1988. I'm not positive, but this might be her first appearance.
It is.
Okay, very good. Moving on a little bit, my notes are a lot more sparse on this one than they were in the last one. On page three, Carol is playing the voice of doom here. I mean, I tend to have a wait-and-see kind of attitude when it comes to dire situations like this. But, yeah, she's like, oh, he could be gone forever. Well, you don't know.
Right. She's jumping to conclusions that
baseless. Some people do, and it's a valid character move. It's just that this is not the way that I choose to deal with things. So on page five, I get that this is Hal Jordan's mind that's in the shark's head. What I don't understand is why he has a working ring. It seems to me as though it's just, you know, let's just make this stuff up as we go along, which is in its own way valid. But on the other hand, it should at least make sense.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with seeing Hal without the ring doing his thing. I mean, we just talked about that in when we were discussing the new Green Lantern animated pilot, which if listeners out there, if you haven't heard it yet, you should go and check it out because it is already out. It's been out for at least a month at this point.
Yeah.
But we just recorded it our time. But there's no reason why – yeah, breaking the fourth wall.
Yep.
There's no reason why Hal can't just be there. I mean, even in the Green Lantern costume, since it's not part of like the construct of putting the ring on necessarily, he can still have it when the ring depowers. So it's not like it will actually affect his secret identity or anything. I just don't understand why he even needs to have the ring. He can fight without it, and that would actually – I would find that to be more interesting. Page seven, this Davis guy, I'm thinking to myself, oh, geez, is this guy about to have a heart attack?
Yeah.
Like, oh, no, it's just a little gas. But I think there's going to be something more to that. But again, we won't know about that till we get to it probably next episode at this point. Page 10, the way that this character, Rosie, is introduced, where she's, you know, throwing guys out of Rosie's bar, which is clearly her bar. I mean, there's no two ways about that. I'm in love. Skipping ahead again, page 14. Oh, it's a psychic link with the ring. Now there's where – okay. So there's rules that the link will expire because the ring expires. Okay, making stuff up as we go along. And Shark knows this and points it out to Hal because of all the other Green Lanterns that he's done this to. I mean, I would – it's just so frustrating. I mean, how would he have that information anyway?
Yeah.
Come on. It's just going too far for me. And moving on, page 16, Carol gets into Hal's room by dropping that she's it's Dr. Feldmeyer's orders. That actually makes me think of a scene from – have you guys ever seen the movie Fletch?
Oh, gosh.
He's trying to say that he's some doctor, so he goes and looks at the doctor, and they're all Rosen something. And so he goes up to the nurse and says, "Hi, I'm Dr. Rosen," to try and get the information. And it's just what that makes me think of. Oh, yeah, it's Dr. Feldmeyer's orders. Yeah, Jews are doctors. That makes perfect sense. That's not a racist comment. You can leave it in. Page 18. So it wasn't just a psychic link to the ring. She's actually able to charge the real ring, and then the psychic ring that's in Hal's mind gets repowered. Wow, this story is all over the place.
Maybe she charged the real ring, which subconsciously made Hal think his mind ring was charged. Yeah, I got nothing. Sorry.
I was going to say, that makes about as much sense as, like, you know, I'm in my head and so I'm hungry, and suddenly there are mashed potatoes.
If you build it, they will come.
Yes, and if you make – yes, and my wife made the mashed potatoes for me.
Oh, cool.
Now I really want some mashed potatoes.
Mashed potatoes are awesome, especially with garlic. But you have to put the garlic in while you're warming up the water. Okay, enough about that. Go on. So the final thing is the next issue box that we get at the end of the letters page – is that we're in a case for the DTs next time.
but sadly we're not. We will be getting into that next episode, but the following issue that we'll be talking about once you guys go through your notes is not going to be the normal next issue that they were originally planning. Yeah. And that's it for me. How about, I think it's, is it Michael's turn?
David, I think.
This cover bothers me. It makes me think of things that bother me. I'm not going to get any further into that. When you see the cover, you'll understand. I like on page two, we get a full recap of the previous issue, which basically concludes that that entire issue that we just went through, the whole 23 pages, it really could have been boiled down to one. I appreciate that. Carol Ferris on page three busts me up because the lower left-hand panel, is he Tom? What if he doesn't? I mean, it sounds like a soap opera, and I know comics and soap operas are very closely related, but come on.
Is he Tom? Is what we in the industry called VOD, Voice of Doom.
Dun, dun, dun.
You just
look
need
with
it
your
to
special
be like
eyes.
Like, yes, there are all sorts of possibilities for things that could happen from here on out, but I'm going to focus on the worst possible, worst case scenario. And that's what's reality for me.
Right.
Because I have faith.
I appreciate that. did anybody, we're all in the same age range, did anybody think of Super Shredder on the bottom panel of page five? Like Kevin Nat from TMNT 2, Secret of the Ooze.
Wow, that's an, oh wow!
I have
that
no idea
that was not what I thought of, but the color scheme works.
Yeah, I just picture him, you know, for no reason, you know, knocking things down.
Yeah,
and killing the climax of the movie.
When you mutate yourself, your armor grows too.
Yeah, that works.
That makes sense. It's genetic, but no, it's physical.
It's physical. Yeah. On page eight, are we supposed to believe that one of Hal's biggest fears is being fat? What does that say socially? Because he got fat and a corpse, and he looks a little bit more concerned about the fat than the corpse.
It's a good thing they never did that crossover with Bouncing Boy.
You know what? You can say what you want about Bouncing Boy. He got triplicate girl. Oh, duo damsel. Oop, too soon. It worked out well for him. Let's just say it like that. I like on page 11 with the team coming together that I suddenly just blanked out even though it's right in front of me. The demolition team. Uh-huh. In page 11, and really makes me think of, the village people are reuniting.
It's funny with the demolition team because they really are going with the most stereotypical stereotypes that you could possibly find.
Yeah, above and beyond.
Yes, and yet I actually kind of dig this, and I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, what they do and seeing each individual one. I'm sure that it's going to be broken up so that each individual one attacks Hal Jordan in a different way when we get to that issue.
Oh, yeah.
But I haven't read it yet, and I almost feel like I shouldn't be looking forward to it, but I do, and I get a kick out of this.
It's a guilty pleasure.
And probably because I have a huge crush on Rosie.
Rosie. Never mind. I'm not gonna make that joke.
She's a big big girl who can kick your butt.
There is something attractive about that.
There absolutely is. That's who I married.
And on page 13, did anybody really think this through when they were writing this? Because the doctors are putting instruments on Green Lantern through the costume. Now I know in later eras, I mean, the costume was some sort of, you know, biologically connected material, but now, no, we've seen him putting the costume on. No, he fired it up with the ring, didn't he?
Right.
He did fire it up with the ring, so that's why it's kind of actually a little bit confusing, but I think it's one of those things where it's meant to go either way at this point. They don't want to nail it down as being one or the other.
Well, they need to get off the fence.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm with you on that, but I also still kind of feel like I have to accept that that's just the way that they're doing it for right now.
Okay. I thought
forced acceptance.
I had a similar note on page 15 about her sneaking in as a nurse. I just kind of shook my head. I'm like, really? Just really? That's how you're going to go with that? And that kind of segues into page 17. His ring isn't it's still charged. It's only been a few hours, Carol. Why would it occur to you to charge up the ring? Because I never saw the logic in that, because the ring wasn't depleted.
That's right. He just charged it before he left the house earlier that morning, right?
Right.
And now it's like the afternoon. It hasn't been a full day or anything.
No. So, I mean,
but the psychic link drains the ring faster.
And Carol knows this for the same reason that Shark knows this.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I can accept that. That's how they're doing it now.
I don't accept that.
No, but
that's not okay.
I thought the entire climax of the book on the ship was just unnecessary. It could have been done in a different fashion, but instead we get this little lovey-dovey moment with Carol. And then we jump out to this ship. And let's be honest, is that an oil tanker? Because I think they just messed up the ocean.
Yeah.
Cyborg Superman didn't have to do anything.
I don't think it's an oil tanker. It's just, it's a Star Labs tanker. So it must be. It must have some sort of like scientific purposes, and then I don't understand why these guys are going to turn themselves in for dumping toxic waste in the ocean when they had to have been told to get rid of it that way. It's not like they have. I mean, are they stockholders in Star Labs where they will lose money if they get rid of the toxic waste in a different way, where it will actually cost Star Labs more money? It's not going to cost them more money. It's true. A Star Lab ship.
Was that an oil tanker? But there are tanks of toxic waste that just went into the ocean when that thing went up.
Well, yeah, that's what most ships have, is the ships carry around toxic waste. That's their whole point.
Okay. So even the Vikings did. So I can accept that on a historical basis. Yeah. And finally, we get to page 23, the last panel. My only note is facepalm. I'm kind of with you. There's a part of me that's just curious to see where this goes. But at the same time, the demolition team, was this something out of Sonic Disruptors that that they left out?
It's a very 80s action figure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like the Bionic 6 to me.
I just like how everything is yellow. That's not at all convenient.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, those are my notes. This issue I liked even less than the last issue.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely with you there. But about how things went back to the ship, I think they were really trying to make a public service announcement more than anything else, and that was the important thing, and that Len Wein maybe had gotten away from what that public service announcement was supposed to be, and so he realized when he got to the end, oh yeah, I have to bring it back to the boat and say this is bad.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we had a point to this, didn't we?
As for my notes, page one, I really liked the opening splash. There's a lot going on, but it didn't really feel overly busy. You know, if we're going to criticize the writing, might as well praise Dave Gibbons, too, for his... At a certain point, the art on this issue is really the only thing that kind of kept me interested in it. But this is also the first appearance of Tawny Young, as we mentioned, and I just want to point out that she's a TV news reporter, which would make her a talkie Tawny.
And nice.
Yes.
As soon as I saw Tawny, I thought that, but no, you definitely put it together better than I could have.
Page two, I thought that was a very fluid recap. Like Dave said, it kind of recaps the whole issue, making the 175 kind of pointless, but it was more fluid than we've seen in some of the issues we've covered to this point. Page three, and this is really... I don't know, I complained about Carol last issue, so I don't know if you guys want to hear me do it again, but I don't know if it's Ween's writing of the character or just how she is, but she's all over the place here, because she's, like Jeffrey said, she's jumping to conclusions here about Hal's welfare, and then, well, first she seems to be holding up okay, and then she just goes into this big outburst, and then as the issue goes on, it morphs into this kind of wacky sitcom with her and Tom trying to sneak into the hospital. So I don't know if maybe Wein just doesn't have a handle on the character, or maybe he's going for drama and it's just not coming through, or maybe I'm just expecting something that we're not going to get.
Well,
in 1984, but
well, specifically trying to avoid anything to do with, you know, feminine issues, because I don't think that's okay or valid in this case, but right. I could see somebody else making that point, not you guys. I think that it is an attempt at drama here, for one thing. And when she goes to, you know, this is what the worst possible scenario must be, instead of, but what if things really are bad, and instead of, you know, oh man, things are, you know, he really needs us. Maybe, yeah. I mean, I think that she's a stronger character than this, and it's not coming through.
Right. And her portrayal just seems very scattered.
Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, this is also kind of a very human reaction. I mean, it's not to say that any human, male or female, under any circumstances, might not react in the same way. I do find this to be a valid reaction, but I would like to see it more flowing. I would like to see it more consistent.
Right.
Yeah, that was the word I was going to use, consistent. She's all over the place.
She is.
The next note I had is all the way back on page 17. I totally missed that Carol was carrying the lantern as they were sneaking into the hospital.
She claimed that it was invisible, which I think is something they were doing at the time. I think we've kind of seen that before.
Right.
But yeah, she's apparently been carrying the lantern the whole time.
But if you look back, even as far back as page 12, you see her – once you know she's got the lantern in her hand, you see her putting it into the car, and then you see her taking it back out of the car when they get to the hospital, and then as they're going through – she's always got her hand positioned in a way that she could be carrying something, and I just thought that was a really nice touch.
I actually hadn't caught that, but I've been backtracking just while you're saying it, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And then page 23, the demolition team, which looked like action figures. But that's all I had. Less notes because it just wasn't a very good issue, and these kind of mind battles aren't really my favorite type of issue either. But
it's very Lawnmower Man.
But the Letters by Lantern Light column is back to two pages with people still heaping praise on the new direction and Dave Gibbons' art. Lots of praise for the backup story in issue 173 as well, which was the Progress, the Wordless story that we looked at last episode.
I really liked that one. I can't remember if I said good things about it at the time, but looking back, I really liked that one.
Yeah.
It was just really hard to recap. I'm glad that I didn't have to do it.
Yeah. Well, when you don't have words, it's hard to...
I know.
But we're going to take one more break, and then we'll come back, and Jeffrey will tell us all about Green Lantern 177.
In 1992, the greatest hero the world has ever known died defending his city from a force of nature. That force of nature had a name.
Day.
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast is a weekly internet radio program presented by the Superman homepage in association with the Superman Podcast Network. Every week, hosts Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor examine the comic book adventures of Superman from Man of Steel number 1 in 1986 to Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. Now they begin their coverage of the epic Death and Return of Superman trilogy with the first chapter of that story,
Doomsday.
From the first round to the ultimate sacrifice, Mike and Jeff will go through Doomsday in detail with the occasional special guest and a few surprises as well. Doomsday comes to From Crisis to Crisis, beginning December 2011, at both www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com and www.supermanhomepage.com.
And And finally, this time, we're going to take a look at Green Lantern number 177, which had a cover date of June 1984, but it came out March 22nd, 1984. The title for the beginning of this, because it does get a little bit confusing, is Interlude. And this is Len Wein as the writer and editor. Chuck Patton is the penciler. Bob Smith is the inker. And Albert de Guzman, letterer, with Anthony Tollin, colorist. But again, there is going to be a tiny change once you get a few pages into it. Once you get to page three, it is a flashback, and the only thing that's different is that it is penciled by Dave Cockrum. And so once you get to page three, the title changes to The Green That Got Away. So, now that the ship from last issue has gone the way of the Titanic, Green Lantern rescues the now dozen or so people who were on it, because if you remember, there were only two last time. They seem to multiply with water like Mogwais and Gremlins, and they have also built wooden boats to be brought in, because before it was just in a Green Lantern construct of a raft. He brings them to shore, where the toxic waste dumpers say that they will turn themselves in and take their medicine. After a public service announcement about ocean dumping, several reporters, including Tawny Young, accost Green Lantern and ask what it's like to have his soul stolen by Shark, since she is privy to that information somehow. Hal considers that this was not the first enemy that has stolen something precious to him, not by a long shot. And so this is where we flashback on page three to an undescribed amount of time ago, although it would have to be at least a year since he is on Earth. Green Lantern is chasing two robbers who had stolen a truck with two vintage cars on its back. In fact, I believe there are also other vintage cars under the top layer, but it's kind of hard to tell for sure. They shoot at Hal, but Hal quickly turns their bullets into green daisies, as Green Lanterns are wont to do. The driver presses the button to release the antique cars on the top layer, but Hal catches them and puts them safely back on the ground before anyone, including the cars themselves, get hurt. But then his ring begins to sputter and stop working. He falls from the air and manages to bounce off an awning to land safely on the city street. With his ring not working, he gets into one of the antique cars and continues the chase. Fortunately, he knows these streets. This is in Los Angeles. He knows them really well and manages to get ahead of the truck. He stands in front of it and bluffs a threat, like, I'm going to hurt you if you don't stop. And it works, and they surrender before the truck actually hits him. Once they're in custody, Hal asks his ring what the heck is going on, but it responds that it cannot tell him, and that the other has ordered him to remain silent. Ordered him, as in the ring. I suddenly made it masculine for no apparent reason. But Hal knows that something has been stealing his ring's energy and that it was time to find out who. Hal figures that even though the ring can't tell him who did it, that it can still point to the direction of the stolen energy, which leads him eventually to the state penitentiary and Hector Hammond. Apparently, Hammond has been stealing little pieces of Green Lantern energy for some time now and can use it as though he's wearing a ring to hit Hal with constructs and to make himself walk, fly, and all the good stuff that Green Lantern rings allow you to do. For now, he's been taking the energy and going out into he's been taking the energy and going out into space looking for fragments of the Starborn meteor that first gave Hammond his future evolved mind. Didn't we just have a future evolved character? Who wasn't nearly as cool as Hammond? Who wasn't that cool to begin with? Hammond escapes and traps Hal, but Hal manages to struggle free. He recharges his ring and takes off into space to follow Hammond. Hammond hurls a bunch of meteors at him, but Hal is able to deflect them. They both create giant hand constructs and end up arm wrestling with them. Hal wins just before Hector runs out of power, and then he puts Hammond into a protective bubble and heads back to Earth. So flash forward to the present again, where Hal breaks off from the interview with Talkie Tawny and his own introspection, by the way, since that's really what he's breaking off of. And he goes to save a passenger jet that has lost both of its wings in a lightning strike. He manages to land the plane, but has some difficulty slowing it down on the runway. First, he tries a giant pillow, which does not work, and then he tries a giant marshmallow, which seems to do the trick. The pilots wave to him and thank him and say that they owe him their lives, but Hal responds that they owe him nothing and that he's just glad he could help. He's glad he has this ring, and he intends to keep wearing it forever. Later on Oa, or possibly at the same time, the Guardians notice that the planet Omicron Ceti 4 is unstable and will soon explode if there's no intervention. Time is of the essence, and they must contact Green Lantern of Sector 2814, Hal Jordan.
I guess it's me up first, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I just want to, right out of the gate, this cover is a complete turnoff from the issue. I know green is kind of a theme, but this is ridiculous. Plus,
it's really heavy with the green, yeah.
Yeah, and Hal.
It's funny because I'll get to it in my notes, but I'll let you go. I'm sorry.
Okay, Hal just looks off too. But is it only me that kind of looked at page 3 at the transport and said, "Oh, good, Hot Wheels." But I mean, look at them; they're perfect. I mean, it's exactly what that would be sell. And of course, I mean, I'm always glad to see Dave Cockrum. I think he's a step up from Patton so far. Patton looks like he didn't go far with the art.
I would have to agree with that. But actually, I looked at that and saw Micro Machines.
Nice. I think I kind of sighed a little when the daisies popped up on page 4. It shoots daisies. That's so hippie. However, it was kind of redeemed by the big catcher's mitts catching the Hot Wheels. And page 5, Hal does the cliched canopy trick. And you actually see the flip that he should have made. But yet, nothing's broken. No construct, nothing stopping. He just flipped and done.
He's Spider-Man.
Apparently. And heaven help me, on page 5, when he gets into the hot rod, I immediately thought, oh, where's the green Hot Wheel track construct from the movie?
Yeah, I can see that. I just find it funny that, okay, well, technically this is now grand theft on my part, but I'll just go ahead and take off.
It's okay when I do it. I'm allowed.
I'm allowed because it's number 14.
No, he has jurisdiction, though. He is considered a law enforcement official. He can commandeer a vehicle. Technically,
it depends on how much Earth recognizes his authority.
Oh, they'll recognize his authorita. I got excited on page 6 because, the truck that he stops looks like Optimus Prime. And it kind of goes with my theory that you could always improve BJ and the Bear by throwing Optimus Prime as the truck.
Right.
There's something they need to remake into a movie. It's an idea that I can really wrap my mind around. A man and his monkey.
Driving a truck, getting adventures.
Of course, no one like it would star Ashton Kutcher. So,
with a guest appearance by Clint Eastwood.
Oh, there you go. It's redeemed. Oh, is Lobo? Oh, we may have something here. Who do we call?
I was making a reference to Every Which Way But Loose.
Oh. Well, see, I got excited because that's still good casting on Sheriff Lobo.
Yeah, and they should also digitally recreate Ronald Reagan to be in it.
Bedtime for Bonzo.
And one last one. They Cody should go Dance. Ahead and what's his name? Joey from Friends. Matt LeBlanc.
And Tony Danza.
Dustin checks in. Oh, Tony Danza. Good one.
Yes.
Enough. There are no monkeys in this issue. No, what are we talking about?
Well, they used to put monkeys on issues just because it would sell, and that's in our bloodstream now. We've been doing this for so long that we immediately go to monkeys. Most of my notes on this are superficial, like the middle panel on page 7. Did Hal switch races somehow? Or why did his eyes suddenly became beady? I don't know. There's something wrong with that panel. So the face is scrunched in a way that it doesn't look like Hal. And, of course, we only get his eyes in 2 panels, and then we have the normal blank slits.
Well, there are all sorts of different ways that, eyes are taken, especially when there's a mask involved. I mean, it's the same thing with Batman And, you know, when you get up really close, usually you can see that there are indeed pupils and whatnot. But when you get farther away, there aren't. I didn't necessarily get anything with the race or just that. I mean, for one panel, he happens to be very, very stoned.
Oh, okay. He may be very baked. Okay.
That could explain the flowers.
There you go. It's all coming together now.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
There you go.
Unless you're Hector Hammond.
Yeah, but he's in L.A., so.
And what is – are you guys Hector Hammond fans?
No.
I think he's a good character, but there's just not a lot of stories you can – I mean, every Hector Hammond story is going to be very similar to the last one.
Yeah.
I cannot think of any Hector Hammond stories that I'm particularly fond of. I'm sure that there are some good ones that I've not read yet. I hope that we encounter one or two good ones, but there are none that I've read that I can think of that really stand out to me and say, wow, this character is awesome.
True. But he does get more grotesque as time goes on.
Yes. And I love how he appeared in Rebirth.
Yes.
With Ethan Van Sciver's art.
Yeah. Van Sciver, that was – I'm a Fairweather Van Sciver fan, but whenever he does GL, I'm in.
No, I'm happy with almost anything that he does art-wise. I just disagree with him politically.
See, I don't know his politics. I just don't like his Batman.
Well, I'm friends with him on Facebook, and he posts some pretty incendiary – hardcore, like hardcore right-wing things that go far beyond anything left-wing that I ever post.
Okay. But back to Green Lantern. This is a Green Lantern podcast. Page 8, that last panel of Hector Hammond. He looks like he just found out Vader's his father.
Huh? Oh, yeah. That's not true. It's impossible.
It's just really improbable. My dose jump all the way to page 15. I'm like, oh, a plane crash. They're really ripping off Superman the movie.
That actually did occur to me. But, I mean, at least they're saying, look, both wings are gone. So he has to recreate the wings as constructs. And that's kind of cool.
That part's cool. And then you got the pillow marshmallow thing. That isn't cool.
And in fact, since we're talking about it, I'll go ahead. I don't even have that many notes about this issue, but I'm going to go ahead and ruin one here. On that page 16, I mean, I'm thinking that the most effective construct here would be like a drag racing parachute behind it.
And yet we try a pillow that goes right through and a marshmallow, which does the same thing. No, wait, the marshmallow actually works somehow.
Yes, because the pillow, it rips through and there are feathers all over the place. But on the other hand, I mean, in Hal Jordan's defense, it's got to be hard coming up with these kinds of ideas for constructs on the spot.
Oh, true.
And maybe a marshmallow, a giant marshmallow, would be a good idea. I've never seen one that big. I would have put Mr. Stay Puft in front of him.
There you go. Two birds with one stone.
You ever tried to kill one bird with one stone? You know how ridiculous that saying is?
I find that a BB gun is easier, but on page 16, the word BAMF appears on the fourth panel. Not only is that a great reference to Dave Cockrum and my favorite X-Man, but it's an apt description for Hal, if you know the code.
The code?
What it stands for.
Oh, okay.
I was trying to be subtle without...
No, I just hadn't actually thought of that as being, you know, a code for what it clearly is. But as soon as I took a look at it, I'm like, okay, what does that stand for? The first try, I got it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I have that printed on my wallet.
Nice. My ultimate note, though, was that I had a hard time following this issue. It bounced around a lot.
Wow, really?
Well, it was just like a bunch of mini stories is what I'm – you know, and the chronology was off. Or maybe that was just me.
Oh, the Flash – well.
Well, the thing is it's – I don't really need to save this for my notes. This was so obviously and clearly a fill-in issue.
Right.
Because the last issue did say, you know, next issue we'll have the DTs, and clearly that was printed and drawn before it was realized that there would need to be another issue before this. By the time you get into the beginning of this issue, the ship that has sunk and the people who Hal has saved off of it are not in any way close to what we saw at the end of the previous issue. You get two pages in, and immediately you go to a flashback that is completely inconsequential to the ongoing story. There is no ongoing story here, really, probably because that's going to be addressed in the next issue, which was probably, you know, on its way to being done, but not going to be done in time. And so this was put in. In fact, I would be willing to guess that the flashback part of it was probably already partly done or drawn, and then they added a beginning and an end to it.
That's actually a good segue to my notes, because my first note was that the flashback portion was originally from Green Lantern 128 from 1980.
I didn't know it was actually in an issue. That's
yeah. Oh, okay.
And interestingly, there it was also a fill-in with a framing sequence by Denny O'Neil and Joe Staton, who were the regular, I believe, team at the time. So, yeah.
So this is like the go-to fill-in issue.
I guess so. Yeah.
Okay, but that makes sense.
The fact that it was a fill-in also ties into why some of the issues of late have had backups and some haven't. Because reading through the letter columns, apparently the original plan was to drop the backup stories and then have just full book-length issues. But Dave Gibbons had problems doing 23 pages in a month, so they decided to go back to having backup stories in a lot of the issues. And to just give a preview of what's coming up, a letter response in this issue says that we're going to have backup stories from Alan Moore, Kevin O'Neill, Todd Klein, and thanks to the inventory story, Dave Gibbons. So lots to look forward to.
Actually, yeah, the Alan Moore stuff is going to be phenomenal.
Page 3, Hal asks, when will these punks ever learn? And I'm like, never. Never will they learn. I mean, 73 years and people are still shooting at Superman. So.
Well, yeah, that and they keep growing new ones.
Yeah.
New punks.
Page 6, I love that Hal just stares down the semi-truck with no juice in his ring at all. That's probably my favorite moment in three stories we've covered to this point.
Yeah. I like how it kind of works. I mean, on one hand, I don't like it. On the other hand, I really do like it. It's one of those things I'm kind of torn. But it probably is, at the same time, my least favorite and most favorite part of the issue. Because it shouldn't work in real life, yet in comics, it's awesome.
Yes.
And since it's in a comic, I'm going to go with it's awesome.
Right. Pages 9 and 10, and I'm surprised neither one of you brought this up, and it makes me think maybe I'm just missing something, but I don't really understand how Hector Hammond was able to steal or siphon off Hal's power.
For me, it's one of those things you just have to either buy into or ignore it entirely. And if you ignore it entirely, you're ignoring most of the issue. And so that's the main reason why I was like, you know, do we really even need to get into it? I'm not saying that you shouldn't have gotten into it. I'm glad that you did, because I didn't.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense that he'd be able to do that. And even if he could, I don't know how he was able to store that power until he had collected enough, because the ring depletes every 24 hours, whether Hal uses it or not, or I don't know, 12 hours if you look at the last issue. But so it doesn't make sense that Hal would be able to, or that Hammond would be able to store that for months with no battery and no connection to the main power battery on Oa. Plus, Hal defeats him by using that very fact, just waiting for it to run out, and that's how he defeats Hammond this issue. So it just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, I really do prefer the version of Green Lantern where you have a ring that if you don't use, it works kind of like a cell phone. I mean, a lot of people have cell phones, so I think a lot of people can relate to this. If you don't use your cell phone, it will still run out of juice over time.
Right.
But not nearly as quickly as if you're using it all the time.
Yeah.
And I prefer that version of the ring. That's not okay. The version of the ring that we have right now. The version that we have is the 24 hours, which is why what you're saying makes absolutely perfect sense, and you're absolutely right, and that is a problem.
And that's probably why we didn't notice.
Yes.
Until he pointed that out, so.
Well, I mean, I noticed it, but I just let it fall to the wayside because I just didn't even know what I wanted to say about it.
Yeah.
Or I think I was probably reading it and I was like, you know, I don't even know if I want to take notes on this issue anymore.
page 12, I really like the art on that page. I really wish Dave Cockrum would have done more Green Lantern at some point because I think he would have had a good run on the title. Page 15, I kind of got a laugh because Tawny asks Hal a question and he just drifts off into this rambling narrative about something completely unrelated, which makes me think Hal is a closet podcaster.
I salute that.
But the thing is that green tea is really good.
Exactly. Right. Page 17. The world is safe again, Superman, thanks to you.
Oh, took me a minute. Okay. Like, wait,
a hugely self-serving moment.
Right. And the only other note I had was I didn't.
It's so much funnier if he'd said, you know, don't thank me, I hate you guys.
The only other note I had was I didn't know if this Omnicrom SETI 4 was a Star Trek reference, because apparently in the original series there was a one of the episodes had an Omnicrom SETI 3. So
that's where they dropped Khan.
No, that was
SETI Alpha 6, but
yes.
But it was the series of planets that, but yeah, I don't know if it was a direct reference, but yeah, I took the reference.
It does sound like a star, and by saying four, you're saying it's the fourth planet in that system, so.
But that's all I had on that story.
All right, I have very few notes, to be honest with you, but this cover, it's a much simpler cover than the last two, but by comparison alone, I dig it. Just by comparison alone. And I think that's Gil Kane's art, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, and so that actually does help. Even though Hal, his face looks a little wonky, his body looks a little wonky. There's a lot that's really not necessarily great about this cover. But of the three that we're looking at, if I saw all three of them and only had 75 cents to get one of them, this is the one I would pick up.
Oh, yeah. It's more iconic, at least.
Certainly. But as I mentioned, it's obviously a fill-in issue. It definitely shows. I do have to mention, I think I might have before, that I prefer Gibbons' art to either of these guys. I don't mean for this podcast to turn into like a love letter for Dave Gibbons' art, but it kind of is, especially when we do have something to directly compare it to. And in this case, we have a couple of artists, and you know, neither of them are necessarily bad. I would prefer probably the first one over the second one, but I really much prefer Dave Gibbons' art, so yeah. I don't know what else to tell you. Page one, I did make a reference to this before. There were so many people. There were two people on that ship before. Hal saved them both, and now not only are there a couple of dozen, they have actual boats.
Yeah, I didn't notice that when I was doing my notes, but you're absolutely right.
On page two, yeah, again, hearkening back to something that I mentioned from the first issue, they explain what EPA stands for. And when you're a little kid and you don't know what those things stand for and people talk about the EPA, it's awesome to see what it actually means. And I love that they do this because they don't have to, but they do it anyway. And that's cool. And how does Tawny Young know that Green Lantern's mind was stolen by the shark? I mean, the shark disappeared and is now dead. He hasn't even told Carol that his mind was taken over by the shark. Tawny might be a bad guy.
Dun, dun, dun.
Only not at all. So just to go to show how few notes I have, that's page two. I have one note left because I already did one of them, so I've only got one left. On page 14, where they're doing the thing where they both created hands and giant hands as constructs, and they're now arm wrestling. Cosmic arm wrestling is my favorite kind of arm wrestling.
And that's I didn't know what to do in terms of notes. I'm like, yeah, that's there, but I just ran out of jokes, so well played, sir.
Yeah, I mean, with something like this, I mean, all that I can really do, I mean, I could take the time to just tear it apart and say all the things that are wrong with it. And, I mean, we kind of did that in the discussion, so I didn't really need to go that far with it with the notes. But we do, however, have a tale called Final Duties, which is a 6-page backup story from the Green Lantern Corps, or Tales of the Green Lantern Corps. And this one... You know, I didn't like this so much the first time through, but I've now read it 3 times, and I like it more each time. But I'll get into that a little bit more with my notes. For now, I actually decided that this is one that's really hard to recap, and since there actually are words, I'm just going to go ahead and read it. It's not going to take that long. It's only 6 pages. So, this is Tales of the Green Lantern Corps, Final Duties, with Len Wein as the writer and editor, Gil Kane, artist, Ben Oda, letterer, and Anthony Tollin, colorist. Now, this is a character named Quo Varick, and it says, Quo Varick's final days as a member of the proud Green Lantern Corps begins, as had all the others, with the rising of his homeworld's buoyant crimson sun, the recharging of his power ring, and the reciting of his ancient sacred oath. The ritual completed, he pauses at his window for a moment, taking in the summer sweet scent of the distant Dabala trees, yeah, some of these are going to be hard to say, and the crystal song of the feathered wind flights in their branches. Even for one who has traversed the cosmos, there could be no better place to live out the remainder of one's days. He smiles, and he thinks, time enough for contemplation later. There is much to be accomplished before this precious day is done. First, Quo Varick stops at Minos 3, wielding his power ring to prevent a hydro train wreck and thus saving thousands of lives. And then he flies on to Minos 4. The planet is once again racked by violent quakes, he notes, threatening the primitive civilization which struggles to survive here. Quo Varick has rescued these peaceful tribes before, but he will not be here to do so again, and thus his choice is clear. The task takes slightly more than an hour, and when it is at last completed, Quo Varick is pleased. Minos 4 is safe now, at least for the foreseeable future, and he thinks, they worship me without reason. I merely do what I was chosen to do. Nothing more, nothing special. Quo Varick notices the attacking battle fleet as he approaches the planet Krodar. The Krodarans and Rygothians are obviously at war, he sighs, again. How many times has he tried to put an end to these childish conflicts, he wonders. How many times has his efforts been in vain? But no blood will be spilled today, swears Varick. No, not today. Netting the Rygothian battle cruisers like so many floundering fish, Quo Varick tows them homeward, and he thinks, I must remember to tell my successor about this foolish feud. Perhaps he will be wise enough to finally put a halt to it. Leaving the Rygothians with a stern, but he fears fruitless, warning, Quo Varick flies on to a planet once called Bloodworld, now known as Elysium. Here, 200 years before, Quo Varick had fought and defeated the despotic warlord, I can't pronounce this, Kronak Khan, and brought peace to this troubled world. Now, Quo Varick's deed is remembered as the stuff of legend, if at all, and his journey here is a melancholy mission at best. There's no need on Elysium now for the power of Green Lantern. Or is there? Varick spies an old man puffing in a hopeless pursuit of the runaway plaything a child obviously the owner of the toy, struggling to keep pace behind him, trying to read it too fast. For an instant, Quo Varick remembers his own youth, now a thing of distant memory, and he hands the child the elusive kite string, and he thinks, I did my work well here on Elysium. Aye, very well indeed. So he gave the kid back his kite. It's kind of nice. On the final leg of his sector-wide sojourn, Quo Varick observes a massive meteor storm streaking toward the densely populated planet called Balgus 6, and uses the awesome power of his ring to turn these mighty juggernauts from their path.
This cosmic debris can be put to much better use, he determines. And so he guides the hurtling meteoroids across the void to a planet barely out of the birth throes, where he protects the storm from the destructive friction of atmospheric entry, and then directs the monstrous mass onto the churning heart of an azure sea. And he thinks how intriguing it would be to return here one day to see what my simple efforts have wrought. And we do see an animal coming out of the water, which I don't quite get if that's supposed to be from the meteors or already on the planet, but I don't really know. Okay, final page. At last, Quovaric reaches Oa, gleaming jewel at the center of the universe, home of the immortal guardians, to find his successor waiting. Retirement is not an easy thing for Varric, but he surrenders his power ring gracefully and feels a tear come to his eyes as he watches another being receive the awesome energy that has been his for so many years. Then the ceremony is over, and he knows the guardians have once again chosen well. Silently, Quovaric turns to leave, and a voice, quite literally older than time, halts him in his steps. Is Quovaric satisfied the guardian wonders? Have his long years of service been kind to him? Is he, after all, truly happy? Gently, Varric nods, and he thinks, it was a beautiful kite. The end. And so whoever wants to go first, I honestly don't have a lot of notes about this, just one overall, but whoever wants to go.
What you got, David?
I really didn't have anything other, like, in terms of page by page. I thought I kind of had the same experience as Jeffrey. The first time I read it, I was like, it was okay. Went back and reread it because I never really put the beautiful kite line into the right context. Mm. And I don't think I have yet. I think it was maybe a reference that it's the simple things. But overall, I thought it was, you know, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good, not melancholy, but sort of a very sad in a way. Resigned, is that the word I'm looking for?
I think the word you're looking for is not melancholy, melodramatic.
Melodramatic. Well, I mean, we've all come to the end of certain cycles, graduation from high school, things like that, and we appreciate the time we've had. Huh?
I never graduated.
You just kind of gave up?
No, I dropped out and went to college when I was 16.
No, I was gonna do an Office Space reference.
Oh, okay.
You just decided not to go anymore.
Yeah, no, I was sick of it.
What about your grades?
It's like the first cell phone that I owned. I got a cell phone in 2001, and by 2003, I got sick of people calling me, so I just stopped paying the bill till the problem went away.
There you go. Thank you. What I'm trying to say is I enjoyed it, but I don't think I really got the full gist of the ending, and maybe you guys can enlighten me.
Well, I mean, he does say it was a beautiful kite because of all the things that he did that day. He saved a lot of lives. He did a lot of good on a cosmic scale. But the thing that he's focusing on was the child's smile when he let go of his kite in the wind. He grabbed the kite string and handed it back to the child, and the child was happy that he had his kite back because he thought it would be gone.
So it's kind of the little things, that one little moment, right, is what makes him happy. Okay.
Exactly, and it's very melodramatic, which
I guess I was looking for something more, I guess.
Gotcha. No, I mean, I really can't stand melodrama most of the time, but in this case, I mean, I kind of get it for the sake of the character. I mean, he's definitely older. He's been around at least 200 years because it says that he's been a Green Lantern for a couple of hundred years. One of the things that I found interesting is that, you know, Green Lanterns probably don't retire very often.
No. Most of the time, they probably die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would never – I mean, he said he was doing it for how long? If I can go back through the story.
I want to say it was at least a couple of hundred years.
Okay. That must be hard to give up when you think about it.
It's got to be. And because he's an alien, it's very difficult to gauge exactly how old he is, relatively speaking. Clearly, this race lives longer.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was a great story. I don't have page by page either, since it was so short. But I really love these, you know, a day in the life type of stories. And that's basically what this is, just on a much larger scale, which is appropriate since it's a Green Lantern / superhero story. But I just really liked it. I thought the art was excellent. I know a lot of people don't like Gil Kane's art in this part of his career, but I thought the art here was really good. This main panel here on page one is really awesome with the emerald energy swirling around as he charges his ring. And that's really all I had about it. These shorter stories are hard to do page by pages on, you know, but I really enjoyed it.
Well, it was so short that I felt like to really get the essence of what it was in a recap is darn near impossible, but it would only take me a couple of minutes to just read through the whole thing, so yeah. That's why I went ahead and went that route this time. It's not something I intend to do every time, of course.
That might be something I could complain about, because if you're able to just read it and understand it, like for the listener, if you're able to read the story and they get the gist of it without seeing the artwork, that means it's probably a little overwritten because you're not letting the art do its job.
Ah, true.
But that didn't occur to me until Jeffrey did the synopsis, so yeah.
The art definitely does lend itself to it, but on the other hand, I mean, something that I'm learning as a fledgling comic book writer is that, you know, sometimes you really do need to say more, and sometimes you need to pull back and say less. I'm very good at saying less. I mean, when I write, I tend to be very succinct.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's just comics and movies are related that way. There are scenes that could be played a number of ways on the screen where maybe there's no dialogue and you use the actor's faces, which can be done in the art as well. And sometimes the dialogue needs to be really heavy.
And when you have a good artist, like in this case, this is Gil Kane, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. When you have a really good artist, you can do that. You can have it be a lot less. I mean, we just talked about a story where it was almost entirely art and very little in the way of writing. But I mean, that story still had to be written.
Yeah,
but you can also leave it
structure
up to the artist to write it if you at that point if you want to.
And it's also dependent on the working relationship. There's a lot of things that go into it. And it's a choice. And in this one, I don't think that the inner monologue I wouldn't hold it against the story. It worked here.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't necessarily work in another one. So we've got two ends of the spectrum, and they both worked for me.
Cool.
In the Letters by Lantern Light column, there's even more people praising the turnaround on the book. Apparently they haven't gotten to the shark issues yet. one letter I found a little interesting was from a Howard Alper of New York, New York. He wrote saying, among other things, that he wanted to see a Green Lantern story where he teamed up with his fellow Justice Leaguers, specifically Superman. And Ween replies that Julie Schwartz had been trying to get him to do a Superman Green Lantern story for DC Comics Presents. And, quote, "The story is on my agenda and you should be seeing it soon." Don't think that story ever came out. Well, I know it didn't ever come out in DC Comics Presents, and I'm pretty sure it never saw publication anywhere else either, given how close we are to Crisis on Infinite Earths. But I found that interesting.
Well, that's too bad. Yeah, DC Comics Presents ends about a year or two after this. I mean, around the time that Crisis on Infinite Earths is going. And that was the big Superman team-up book, in the same way that Batman was always the team-up character in Brave and the Bold.
Right. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Crisis, though, in Dick Giordano's Meanwhile column, he talks about a bunch of different upcoming projects, and under a More on That Later department header, he wrote, "It's too early to give you all the details on our upcoming 50th anniversary celebration, but I can tell you that it will include as many as 20 special issues of regular titles, a 50th anniversary logo which will identify these specials, 12 handbooks of who's who in the DC Universe, and the previously announced History of the DC Universe maxi-series. We felt it appropriate to save this blockbuster maxi-series for this anniversary year because the changes in our universe and the startling events that will unfold within its pages will alter forever the DC Universe and provide some wonderful stepping stones for the next 50 years.
Or 25.
Right.
Yeah, and this is not an era where they needed to come out with a new Who's Who or a new, you know, History of the DC Universe basically every 2 years, which right. is what we've been doing for the past decade or so.
Yeah. But he says to look for odd occurrences in DC titles from now till the end of the year, and they will provide additional clues as to the who, what, where, and when, and why of the DC Universe maxi-series and the 24 planned books. Obviously, that's all a big foreshadowing to Crisis, which I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering right, Crisis was not planned originally to be a big reworking of continuity.
No, it wasn't.
Right.
In fact, that's one of the things that I've read interviews with Marv Wolfman where, I mean, he had the idea for what he wanted to do. It was not necessarily going to be a huge game changer for the DC Universe when he was initially pitching it. And it took a couple of years to get it to go. But he did want it to actually encompass the entire DC Universe, which is to say it would be a story that had almost all of the current characters in the DC Universe, but it wasn't necessarily going to be the big game changer that it turned into.
Right. Like I said last episode, until we get past the hurdle that is Crisis on Infinite Earths, we're not really going to be spending too much time on guest appearances, but for the sake of completionists out there like myself, I plan on giving a quick rundown each episode. So in the time period we covered this episode, which was January through March 1984, Hal made appearances in several other books across the DC Universe, even though most of them were just kind of one-panel cameos. First up was Flash 332, which, as we talked about earlier, repeats the scene from Green Lantern 175. And then we had Action Comics 554, with a one-panel cameo with the rest of the Justice League of America. That's a good issue if you guys are... I know David and Jeffrey are Superman fans, but if any of you listeners out there are Superman fans, definitely try and track that down. And then there was World's Finest Comics number 302, another one-panel appearance with the Justice League, in a backup story that kind of served as an epilogue to the story that wrapped up in World's Finest 300. And the biggest appearance of the month was Saga of the Swamp Thing 24, where Hal appears with the rest of the Justice League. This is during Alan Moore's run, which I haven't read, so I can't tell you specifically what happens. From what I could tell from online synopses, it's basically the JLA standing around in the satellite while Swamp Thing fights the Floronic Man. And finally, there was Supergirl number 20 with a blink-and-you-miss-it cameo of Hal Jordan with a slew of other heroes celebrating the anniversary of Supergirl's arrival on Earth, which was 25 years ago, real time, when that comic was published.
Who's the Supergirl?
I don't know.
There's no such thing.
That's all I've got. Any final comments for this episode, guys?
It gets better from here. This was a very challenging episode to put together. It was hard to pull notes. Sometimes you go to the well and it's just a geyser, and sometimes you're just really stretching.
Before you sit down to your bacon and eggs, you have to eat your oatmeal. And that's what this episode was.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can put raisin in the oatmeal.
Yeah, in this case, they looked like raisins, but they turned out to be shark poop.
Next episode, we'll be looking at Green Lantern 178, 179, and 180, where Hal battles the village people, or as the comic calls them, the demolition team.
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah. I think it'll be better than these three issues. Knock on wood.
All right. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next month.
See ya.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weider. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then,
in brightest day,
in blackest night,
no evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware our power.
Green Lantern's light.
tune in. It's a podcast. You download it. You don't tune in. That's radio. Bye, everybody.